Welcome, everybody, back to another episode of Winter is Coming, a podcast about housing justice. And we particularly look at housing justice in our communities, where those of us who are bringing you this podcast come from, which on your maps now you might see as Kitchener-Waterloo, but that is the traditional territories of the Haudenosaunee, the Anishinaabe, and Neutral peoples who stewarded this land for thousands of years and from whom we have a ton to learn about living and neighborliness and housing and justice. And so we are joined today by Kirsten Wright from Leadership Waterloo Region and Wilfrid Laurier, and she is part of the Affordable Housing Lab. I'm really excited to talk to Kirsten today. We are both, though you can't see us probably, we're both wearing our white sweaters. We came matching in a uniform. We're so in line. I am coming live from a closet. I'm trying a new space. So listeners, let me know if you think that the audio quality is slightly higher because I'm sitting in a closet right now trying this out. I have a friend, Kirsten, who does, I didn't even mention this, I have a friend who does voiceover. He lives in France and he does voiceover work. And I was Zooming and playing some online games with him this weekend. And he was telling me about his closet where he records his audio stuff. And so I was like, I'm going to try recording from my closet. So that's where I'm coming from. Kirsten, you are coming to us doing incredible work in the area of housing, of affordable housing, and of looking at this, our systems. Really, the last few episodes, we've looked at kind of different levels of government and policy and legislation, and what does it look like for those actors to take us from housing crisis to housing justice. You are doing really incredible work looking at how do we rethink the systems of housing to move us to a better, a healthier, a more liberated and just place. And so can you talk a little bit, maybe just kind of a brief intro? What is your role? What's kind of your day-to-day work and what's kind of the projects, just as an intro, your title and your role kind of description right now?
So I'm working with Leadership Waterloo Region, teaching their Affordable Housing Lab. So my background is in engineering and systems design engineering. And then I started working on social innovation as this sort of side interest, working with Frances Wesley when she came to Waterloo. So taking an engineering perspective, I got really interested in process design as well. So I sort of like welding and making stuff and like how factories work.
Nice.
And then I started to get interested in how economies work and like, well, how do you actually use that same, like just make things work, and how does that work in process design, right? And there are these stories of like Rios partners, you know, running labs in South Africa and that playing a role in how, you know, there's all kinds of problems, but South Africa is not a failed state, right? And that creation of truly shared narratives that got picked up by HEPS, that kind of process stuff can actually affect like an outcome at the level of the society. So we started working on the design of social innovation labs and process and bringing this kind of design approach into like just how you listen at scale and make a society that's responsive and just, if power is as low as it can be for each decision, but you also have standards that everyone's getting the best quality in the world because it's to the highest standard, but the power is truly local and responsive and centered in listening.
I love that. And we just talked last week with Steph Stretch, who's a municipal council candidate. By the time this comes out, the election will have happened yesterday. So I hope I hope people voted for her and if they're in Ward 10. And so just talking about, yeah, that idea of the critical importance of local, of being local and grassroots initiatives, and especially for local folks who are experiencing housing insecurity or are street involved, for them to be leading the actors in saying what is effective, what is needed. I think that's super powerful. And I also just, I love the connection between engineering and how we can look at, you know, a lot of people think of engineering as, okay, they're going to be going into maybe, and there's lots of ways, electrical engineering, chemical engineering, and there's like people who can go and work for gigantic software companies, and I'm sure have a ton of money thrown at them. I just so admire where you've taken your passions and your gifts, and to think about how can we, how can you use those skills and those engineering skills to say, how can we create these better systems with, and I love you mentioned high quality, not just saying, well, we're just trying to get the bare minimum. We're just trying to put a roof over someone's head and walls and make sure that they're heated in the winter. Of course we want that, but to actually say, can we actually offer high quality housing and homes and communities to people? And I, so I just think it's, I think what you do is so important and beautiful, and is a window into something that I think we don't often really get to peer into. So, tell me, what was your first, introduction to housing justice, to affordable housing? How did it first come to your attention as someone who, you know, again, as an engineer, you could have gone many directions here. What, how did it first come to your attention, and how did it kind of draw you into doing this work?
Affordable housing's been the center of my work for about 2 years now. And that's when you started to see really it just got to the point where it's a crisis. Before that, you know, since I started school in undergrad, I've worked in systems. So I did systems design engineering. And what that is rather than diving into sort of the details of chemical or mechanical or electrical, you take that common property, right? You work, you do the math, the equations, and then each of these approaches, they're your example cases, right? So you have one introduction to the algebra, to the geometry, to the algorithms, and then you have 10 examples that map across all these systems. And it's not the human system, right? But it raises this question, of course, when you're listening to people and like the like it's a totally different set of methods in a way. So for me, it's grounded in, you know, I sort of got, I my sense was like I'd gotten to the end of where I could go with technical, sort of the technique, writing code and building. And I started this project that got me to have 5,000 conversations. Actually worked with the Green Party, knocking doors in 2019, and you know, had 5,000 conversations at the door and listened to what people actually cared about. And so from there, it's just very clear, right? There is a crisis, and you know, you can't bring together five or seven people without it being an immediate concern for them now, right? And then you put that, sorry, go ahead.
I should say that that's just something to, I think, to I just want to pause on that for a moment, that especially your experience, and like you said, having thousands of conversations, knocking on doors, and knocking on doors in a context where people are open to say what is really critical, what is important to them. And I love what you just said, that you can't bring five or seven people together without without this coming up. That that just speaks to, you know, this is not a flavor of the week issue. This is not just a headline. This is affecting, and affecting everybody, not just folks who are how street involved or housing insecure. It's affecting all our communities, and so we need solutions for all of us.
And what's so striking with the numbers coming out of CMHC now is this reaches far into the middle class. And if this trend continues, which it will without a response, it's a threat to the middle class. Like it's a threat to the way people expect they're going to get to live their lives. What's so striking for me, especially in these sort of like urban center of communities, again and again, you'd start these conversations and the you know, the people who are leading the conversations, who've been doing that advocacy, who've been doing all of the informal support, you know, if somebody has an immediate threat, you know, I may get evicted and I can't afford to live in my neighborhood, right? There's no us,
And
them division.
I know many people who that who have had that exact experience, either rent evicted, or just coming to a time where they maybe they have a bigger family and so need a bigger place, and to then go out onto the market if you haven't been there for 5 years and find just the criminally high market for rental prices, not just for, and again, we've said this in other conversations, this is not just about soaring home prices in market real estate, although that is certainly a symptom of this larger problem. But this is affecting everybody who needs shelter, who is everybody, without exception.
And I want to highlight on that point and then go to the like, because it hits the most vulnerable most heavily,
Yes.
right? And it's also true, like spend enough time on both of these. It's also true that it's an existential risk to the middle class, right? Those things can
Yeah.
be true. And the traditional model of homeownership has been key to how we've built the wealth of the middle class, right? And Canada has a middle class that's very unusual all through history, right? And it's much more naturally redistributed than, say, Germany. Germany needs to do a bunch of redistribution programs, social ownership, all of that infrastructure to get to where we get because of, you know, the way parents can support their kids and the way we can flow the rents that are captured in private home ownership back in, right? So that private home ownership has created something very unusual, almost by accident, that middle class. It's also true that it's been the dividing line that has driven a lot of the racial wealth gap, a lot of the kid youth lack of opportunity for those whose parents don't have the resources faced. Like
Yes.
it's driven inequality and it's held the base of wealth in communities, right? Those can both be true. And when you say, you know, they have a larger family, right? Have a couple of kids and you have to move to the suburbs or you lose your whole community in lots of ways. There's a particular gap there. So Dawn Parker's research has done some of the demographic analysis, and there's a huge supply gap specifically in the multi-bedroom units in the core near transit. If you want to get a handle on climate change, you need to have homes that people can live in, not have this washer cycle where people maybe can live there when they're single,
Yes.
but then they have to move out and then maybe they move back when they retire as empty nesters. You have to actually be able to live your whole life in community, and that's how you build that support and caring and dynamicism and transit use and all the things that you're trying to do, right? So you can't get out climate change unless you have people have places to live in these green communal centers where they can share and, you know,
Yeah.
volunteer,
Wow.
help each other.
Like that's such a it's such an important, again, I think as we go on with this series, we want to just continue highlighting just the intersection that housing has with so many other important topics and issues. And again, Mike Morris talked about it a little bit in our episode with him too. But just yes, that there is a deep connection for those who say, well, I'm really passionate about the climate crisis. That's we need those people and to understand that this has a has a, an integral part to play and an integral connection to how we fight the climate crisis, how we create green communities with high quality housing, how we do that is going to drastically affect how we're able to combat climate crisis. And so I think that's just an important thing to, I just want to catch that for our audience and just kind of let that breathe that this is not an isolated issue. And for those of us who come from a Jesus neighbor ethic, like the Hub and Trinity, and particularly with focus on how do we show up in solidarity with the most vulnerable and with those who have been targeted and who have been made marginalized, that is where we want to be able to dedicate our attention. And it is so important to recognize growing poverty anywhere that pushes the middle class into poverty. We don't want to see poverty grow. At any rate. And so whether you're thinking it's an isolated issue because you're not in the market or because you're focused on other topics, this has so many housing injustice has so many tentacles that reaches into all these other aspects of life. And so I really appreciate you highlighting both of those, the climate crisis fight and the threat to growing poverty and growing income disparity, pushing a middle class into poverty.
When you talk about intersectionality, like housing is just central to that because it's place, right? It's placemaking. It's where our homes are. It's where our workplaces, the parks that kids play at, it's where our churches are. All of this infrastructure is has to be in some kind of a place, right? And
Yes.
so, you know, that's the reason that by far the best way to decarbonize is the built environment. You know, what are people using their cars for? To drive kids to sports, to drive, go to holidays, to work, to get between places. So it's your transit, it's your built or else it's you can build a house to passive house standard and save a huge amount of money. So you there's no methane being burned every time it gets cold, right? Which gets to energy poverty. So the vast majority of our consumption is to make houses, to put stuff in, and to move between them. So you can decarbonize with only basically through the built environment, your bike lanes and your parks and your market, public markets and public spaces, to get to your factories, which are in the built environment too, right? And then who owns them and who runs them and how is that distributed as well? So the ownership actually doesn't just reflect old inequalities, but actually it's like who's making value now? How do we hold that in community when it's so easy to shop online? So the money just flows out, right?
Absolutely. And I know in our, I mean, we've got more gigantic Amazon warehouses going up. All there's one just where just across the bridge from where I used to live and went to high school. There's a big one in Cambridge in Blair that's going up. But I just think that that's the just another great point of when we think about our neighborhoods, our communities. Again, this is something that will that we can have real change and real impact on decarbonizing, but only if we're really looking at that system level and on what where we're investing. How can you talk a little bit about how your work has changed or evolved since the pandemic?
You mean besides just the logistics of childcare?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's part of your life.
I'm also doing a PhD in engineering. That was my misguided attempt at a parental break. So I'm teaching,
I don't
finishing
know
my
how you found
PhD.
time to fit this in today. You do so much.
And so just the logistics of figuring out how to do that focus work with kids around has been always a bit of an adventure. But I mentioned that the like my whole work has been reoriented around this kind of systems change, direct listening, and then putting that understanding of the economy and how you make things, and whether that's how you build funds, how you build factories, how you make buildings, like the direct on the ground. I'm working on a project convened by the what's become the Waterloo Region Community Foundation, or it was the Kitchener Waterloo Community Foundation, on building, you know, whether it's 8 or 15 buildings, but that it's a fully for purpose, not for profit development group that exists to hold and transfer ownership to wherever it would make the most difference, right? To House of Friendship, Union Cooperative, to these incredible models in, well, all of these groups that are like are just outstandingly good at hosting and owning, including emerging groups, equity seeking groups, where it's like maybe you need time, but in 2 years, if you own this building, everywhere 10 blocks around is better. And it's perpetual aligned with the purpose ownership of those buildings. And it's mixed, and some of it's for profit, and some of it's not for profit, and some of it's market rate, and some of it's affordable. So you make the most dynamic, vibrant communities you can. But the entity exists, convened by the community foundation around purpose for multiple years. Before, you know, you then hire developers to do a great job at developing the sites, right? Aligned with purpose and whatever else. But these community groups, you can't build, I mean, you know, right? You can't build relational. You can't do the relational work in the 2 weeks it takes to close land or build, right? You have to find a way to hold that for the 2 years it takes to do the relational work and build the financing. So you build on right ground. It's just like junk food versus healthy food. Healthy food grows over time and you have to wait the full season for the end of it, right? And so much of what happens with the economy is that whoever can buy the land in the 2 weeks, right? It's fast food, it's fast economy. It's not grounded in purpose or in place. And so the wealth flows out and the value flows out. And it's not, you know, in terms of I like to use the analogy of like water, like the wealth is like the water that's feeding these systems. It's not like if you imagine the big capital global flows are like the ocean, that's great. You know, the acceleration and efficiency in downtown New York and all of that. But what it takes to water a field, the sort of that there is water everywhere and it's held in the environment and it cycles and there's clouds, that's also important, right? That's community wealth. And if we have a system where the community wealth flows out, you even if you have the best ocean in the world, you'll have a local drought.
Yeah.
So
That's a great metaphor, and I think that's yeah, it brings to mind to me, it's particularly when you talk about this idea of community wealth, which might be a new idea or kind of a term to people. I think we're so used to kind of the status quo of our settler capitalist economy, which is, get as much as you can, build as big as you can, and like you said, for whether it's more corporations than even individuals that are wealthy, but swoop in and get the land as soon as you can, and hope you can speculate and pay dividends on it. The idea of shifting to thinking about what does it look like to have community wealth, I think, is a really important thing. I don't want us to run by that too fast. I'm aware that it's that one of the things that is critical in this conversation, that even here on this podcast that we need to have and are working to get, is to have Indigenous voices at the forefront, to understand that a community focus is something that in so many ways is counter to this settler system that we have. And when we talk about and that when we talk about land and the built environment, that we need to be having the same way that when we're talking about what needs to happen with our street involved neighbors, when we're talking about this land, we would want the Indigenous folks to be able to be leading us in that conversation as well, and that recognizing that Indigenous traditions and wisdom have so much to teach us about what it means to be community in ways that as settlers we have not even the faintest idea of what it can really look like. Can you talk a little bit more about that idea of community wealth, just from your perspective, and from what does that mean? What are examples of what community wealth looks like?
So I am working with Keepers of the Circle, which is a Northern women's Indigenous organization that has for more than 20 years run community services, community capacity building, training, so all kinds of support. And they're officially recognized, represent Indigenous women in Ontario through those. But they've started a project to build teaching factories, cooperatively owned teaching factories, that in which Indigenous women build wall panels, build passive house homes. And they're built for Indigenous women by Indigenous women. So they look
Beautiful.
at it from a systems perspective. Women and Northern women, especially Indigenous women, are left out of every stage of the housing and built
Yes.
environment stage, from the
Yes.
owning to the creating to the labor, like to the actually having the homes and the environment, to having like a say in how they're designed.
Yeah, the
So
system's design,
they,
yeah.
from that perspective, they had to actually. So, okay, we're gonna like, what would it take to do something that flipped all of that and embedded? So the relational structures first, like you can't shortcut that, like 20 plus years of building it and it being council and fully owned within the community since in Kirkland Lake. But I mean, even the quality of the work, like in the north, driving winter roads, it's dangerous, right? Would you
Yes.
want your daughter in that? And so they build with, like, what can you build in a factory in really good quality supportive conditions with wraparound supports? You can build these wall panels that also happens to be what you need to deeply decarbonize. You put them on pylons. They can be even in the far north, fully off grid. They can be assembled and disassembled, go multiple floors, or be small houses or large houses.
So these are building materials?
So passive house, but I mean, not of big words, but they really, it's just, if you don't want heat to come out of buildings, you have to insulate them. So like
Yes,
that, you could
right.
sum up the built environment climate piece along with transportation, like don't burn stuff while you move between them, and like don't leak
Don't leak.
You
Okay,
know, like
good.
don't
That's
stick a
good.
chunk of like don't have heat come out. Don't stick a
Yeah.
chunk of metal that shunts heat out. So you
That's
just
helpful.
you
As I
it
said,
pack your
I'm not an
house.
expert in this stuff. So that honestly, like that's I think that's helpful for me, just like just these principal foundational concepts that this is about energy efficiency in a fight for in the fight against climate crisis and with better land stewardship. Don't leak. Okay, I got that. Keep
Yeah,
going.
passive house is just insulate. Like when
Gotcha.
you hear passive house, it means insulated houses. So there's tech, there's their solar, your wind, your whatever else. But if you make wall panels that leak, you don't need very much of any of that. Like you can heat it with a can. If it doesn't leak anything, you can heat it with a candle. You
Right.
know, that's not it in principle. And with enough
I
time.
would do that because I'm cheap.
Right.
So you're giving me like too many
Yeah.
ideas here.
I mean, it's, that's not the passive house standard. You
Yes.
use a little ground source heat pump or something, or a
Right.
little. But you need so little if you stop just building badly, right? So if you build in a way that's relational and well formed, and you use best practices, it's again that balance. Like we can just like take the highest standards and the best of like how do you make a wall panel and ground that, and that's what the community owns and shapes according to their. And then you can, as you know, the women come through the training, it's their designs and their ideas. You know, it's already wall panels. It's like a Lego kit. They can build them to be the homes they want, but
Gotcha.
they've built those wall panels so they can integrate whatever design and approach into building it, right? And our only relation is in giving the best access to the labs, to the machines, to finding resources that we can flow in. That's literally all that's needed
Beautiful.
because everything else is there.
Yeah, so almost like it's a stepping out of the way. It's being able to make sure that there are not obstacles, which is again is for those of us and folks that are coming and listening from the settler's perspective. I mean that is a key aspect of what it means to be working towards right relations and towards decolonization is how can we remove obstacles that the settler system has put up? How can we make sure that we're not standing in the way? So I think that, and that's a, we'll also post a link to Keepers of the
Keepers of
Circle
the
as well,
Circle.
so people can get connected and know about the work that they're doing.
And it's, I mean, it is the even the relation between universities and communities has been extractive in the sense that even in its best form, which is give scholarships to the best students and give them a great place to live, they still build their networks in some faraway community and don't go back. So you have this continual drain of talent, and it's very one way, right? And so if you have teaching factories that are owned cooperatively in land trust or in a sort of appropriate like like the legal structures are adapted and chosen by the community in a process where they can be restructured, then you don't have to leave the community for 4 years or get an outside certification to have the access to the best of the university, right? To come in as it's appropriate, to bring people into the factory. And there's things that make a fact, like there's things that make a teaching factory work, right? If you want to do a wall panel and insulate, it doesn't matter. Everyone has the same standards. It's just giving a very free, open relation where this, here's the knowledge. It's open sourced in these corridors and it's available if you want to build with it in whatever way makes sense. And so here's
Beautiful.
it holding the resources, but the governance, the ownership is anchored and owned in the community. And that kind of service, like the relational structures exist everywhere. And you can't do that fast, right? So how do you hold and build these structures like the development corporation that hold the ownership, do the building as a service in service of the community, and then in the long term transfer the ownership so they become these anchors that like hold the wealth it, for those like the working center who will be
Right,
able to
yeah.
then, you know, follow someone when they're going through a break or a crisis of some kind because they
Yeah.
have the space and they can then choose in a way that's responsive to serve.
Yeah, so it just even that idea of yeah that knowledge is not held for membership or profit but is freely offered, that that is an example of what community wealth looks like, and that of course that this would pay dividends, that's an example of a teaching factory, not just for the knowledge itself, but to be able to produce healthier communities, and again that the communities are themselves are empowered to an agency and to choose their future, their destiny, rather than it being dictated by a distant level of decision maker. I think that's a really important thing for us to lean into and to consider how we in all of our communities can lean into this idea of community wealth. How can we get there? And maybe that's a question. Where do you see opportunities for Kitchener-Waterloo, for example, to grow in having an investment in community wealth?
I mean, this is where we just build in this addiction to, like, you have to extract a certain amount, right? And it's both sides, it's a game. Both sides are good in a sense, right? On the one hand, what's buying up our neighborhoods and translation being so much of the housing stock, the financialization market, it's translating it so it gives returns to financialized ownership. That's in all of our pensions. That's what we're gonna retire. So it introduces it makes the communities function less well. It pulls out more rents that are co-created and claims them for someone who has no share in making them, right? Because the wealth is created by people working together, and we know wealth scales with density. That if you just put people together before industrialization, right back to small communities, that the wealth scales super linearly with density. And that's one of the most robust results from complex
Can you
systems.
break
So
that down in a just like so? What you say, wealth scales with density. So what you're talking legit, literally population density.
literally, yeah, that, I mean, that's what you see in New York, Toronto, people living close together. And I mean, you probably think there's an answer. We think that all of the things, all of the networks and possibilities and the things that you're able to get to develop your capacity, because there's this lesson and there's, this language and this different perspective, that just being near all those other perspectives, along with like having access to this company or that company or institution or idea or resource, that's productive. Human capacity is productive. It's not like it's something outside. Human capacity is the engine of productivity and wealth creation. There are some things you can do on the side, like your big factories. But the core sort of engine of productivity and wealth creation is community. It's people near each other creating things. And there's lots of open questions that this raises, but it's such a strong, it shows up in the data so clearly. The field, if you look into the field of urban science, that's the result that underpins the field of urban science. There's a whole textbook that sort of lays out the data and the case. Lots and lots of books and papers. The book
So,
Scale is a great introduction to that.
okay, yeah. Okay, so how does how then do you see this connecting back to housing justice in how we need to design the systems? Because of course, what comes to mind when you talk about that is I think about the particularly over the last 50 years the drive to urban sprawl, kind of moving out of less dense locations, and now in kind of the current context of people who get priced out of living in population dense centers. Like I am a person, and I have many friends. I lived in downtown Toronto, and essentially, eventually, basically got priced out. And I know that has also happened in places like New York as well. So in this kind of moment, how do you see it connecting back to housing justice and to how we need to design what it looks like to have community wealth, to have density, so that our flourishing can go up in the scale.
This is the key result. Like, if wealth created by human capacity, by people being near each other and creating, and that's concentrated in space, then whoever owns that land can extract that rent. What is it worth to be there? And so you're paying to get to be productive. Like, that's what drives the racial wealth gap. That's what drives the loss of opportunity for kids. And if families capture that and feed it back, those who own that land and capture those rents are able to sustain the middle class, a very unequal middle class where those left out get left out, right? Right now, that system is displaced by financialized capital. So that has two parts. That's inequality building, your big tech fortunes, which never got redistributed, and our pensions, which is how do we pay for retirement, right? Which is a really good thing. We need to protect
Yes.
people's pension funds so that it's, so people can retire well. And so if finance owns it, A, they'll get very efficient at extracting the rents. So you'll see much more sucked out, and the speculative cycle will mean they'll suck out even more than the value that's created in the city in
Right.
many cases, right? So when you see in downtown Vancouver empty storefronts, you're capturing the future rents of the city, but pricing it at a way that you're actually undermining in a way the vibrancy of that place.
Yes. And when you say if, and I'm sure what we mean is when finance owns it, who, again, you mentioned kind of big tech corporations where wealth hasn't been redistributed. Who, when you say if finance, who is that?
So, and this is where you go back to the piece about how naturally redistributed is Canada. Nobody has sustained a middle class without substantial private home ownership, without more social ownership and shared ownership. So we're at a crossroads. We know the pattern that sustained the middle class is dead, right? Finance can always get better interest rates, which means except for government subsidies, which we have a bunch to hold home ownership in place, but except for how private subsidies, financial capital will buy up. You see this explosion of capital buying up even suburbs now. Separate from that is production of housing. Buying to claim rents has nothing to do with whether you, there's some links, but the process of building housing is separate from that. And so our choices, we know this private home ownership with single family, it's bad for climate. We're running out of space in terms of the population growth. It will do really well in townships and on the edges, but as a core, we're not going to be able to sustain all wealth with private home ownership. So we need to move to something else for many people, right, who've already been priced out. And there's two paths. One, it's financialized ownership, where we know where that goes. It's the they have big legal departments, and do they fix your toilets? There's so much sort of empirical, like it's if it's purely financialized without any purpose in relation to the community, then your home is owned, and as much rent as can be extracted gets
So we're
extracted.
talking about corporations that own development properties, that own, scores of houses, that own apartment buildings. We're
Yeah.
talking about the corporate interests who wield land ownership.
If it's globalized financial capital, these could be the nicest people in the world, but they're competing against each other. So those who most successfully create wealth, but in this case, it's only rent extraction. So those who most effectively extract the value created by people by being close together. So they're
Gotcha.
just extracting the value created. They're not adding to it unless they're doing development, which is a separate process.
They're just sitting
They're
in an
just
ownership
extract they're
chair.
extracting as much as possible of the value of cities and shared creation.
So
And
folks who,
some people are going to subsidize that. They're going to pay to do their art, right? And they're
right.
going to drain and go in debt. So you extract whatever you can get from it. That's the logic.
Right. So the people who
Or,
sit in ownership but are not part of
yeah.
the creation or the sustenance.
Ownership can be very, very generative. It just doesn't have to be, right? If it's legally committed to grow its extraction, which is what you sometimes see in
Gotcha.
corporations once you're listed, if your only purpose is to grow your extraction share, and you don't have any relation to the growth of capacity or to feeding back in, then you will succeed or you'll fail. But you succeed by extracting more and more of the value created by people being close to each other.
Okay, that's good. I just wanted, yeah, that's I wanted to be able to catch that, especially for those of us from the outside. So that ownership can be generative, I think, is an important thing that for me that's an okay, that's interesting. We won't go, I don't want to disrupt because I don't want to go too down that rabbit hole now, and I want to keep on your thought, but I do think that's an important thing to catch. Ownership can be generative, but if it wants to just be about growth and creating more profits, it will. The inertia, we will naturally succeed at
Yeah.
that, but it does not have to be that way. Keep
So, but
going.
that's the third point, right? That the
Gotcha.
third path, which gives us the benefit that we've had from private home ownership, but shares that with everyone, whether they're homeowners or not, is some kind of ownership that's aligned with purpose, that's invested in the community, where there's a board that can make those decisions, not just for how much can be extracted from the community, but for how much value is created in the community. And that can be anything from a group of people that built and own their own apartment building, to a formal cooperative structure, to public and social housing, to not-for-profits and for-profits that have embedded a purpose lock or commitment to their community, or they have the factory and they're doing the production, they're trying to increase the capacity of that community, but some relation to purpose that's anchored in the community. And we actually want lots of diversity in that kind of ownership structure. It's fine if social housing takes up all of this. But there's a lot of benefits to having a mix of kinds of ownership, but that they have a shared commitment to place, to
Gotcha.
purpose, right? So it's not about how much can you take out of the rents. You know that where your value is coming from is from a claim of the rent. It's the claim of shared production. So how do you feed that back into increasing production or increasing value or increasing community or resilience or offering good retirements to people? We need to
Yes.
orient around building wealth for every person. And our systems actually block that. You know, we block building that repository of wealth so you can be funded on disability, but you can't afford to buy shoes or to enjoy a holiday or to
Yes.
spend time, right? And building that protective community asset, building wealth and autonomy, and then all of these systems, like you know, the best quality of food, right there. We have this wonderful food system in Waterloo, right? So why isn't it cheapest and easiest when you're having a hard time to get the best fresh vegetables and you know, a really good place to sleep and all the basics? It means less expensive, among other things, right? It's human decency, it's a human right, it's making a good shared life, but it's also a whole lot less expensive than trying to fix things once people are in crisis.
So yeah, and I that's a big echo of what I chatted about with Mike Morris in our second episode as well. Is this he names it as it, we have legislated poverty. You know, when we talk about ODSP, which there is a push right now from I believe Mike Schreiner and other politicians that in Ontario we need to double ODSP because folks like I've talked about, I have friends who are needing to make GoFundMes just to make ends meet, which is just a horrific idea.
So we need to flip that so that there's just this superabundance of wealth that's held in the community, that flows to everyone, that offers that same support. And it's the support that lets you be productive, right? You get people out of a poverty trap. They'll repay you 10 times through their art, through the creativity, through the things they do, through the jobs they take, through the way they build, right? It's, do we want to be a nation that's locked in a poverty trap? Or do we want to actually solve that in a way that reconciles with the need for reconciliation and that path that reconciles with how shared wealth has always been? Every tradition has a tradition of shared ownership and legal shared ownership, enclosures, everything enclosed in private ownership. Sure, some people captured that. It has a lot of problems as well.
I think that's yeah, that's really powerful. I think when you talk about, I think that's a really also good connection point for people to catch that you that every tradition actually does have this idea of what it means to have shared ownership, to have community wealth, from the tradition that I ascribe to, and this tradition of the liberating Jesus. There's this Jubilee economy idea, which is the idea that that not only do we forgive debts, but we give abundantly and generously, and that we don't, yeah, that we don't hold these, like you said, these poverty traps, but are constantly, whenever poverty is increasing, this Jubilee economy essentially has this principle about resetting things and setting things right, and giving the abundance to those in need. So I just think that, I'm sure there's many listeners who aren't coming from that tradition. So my encouragement is to go and to think about what is that place that your tradition comes from that is not like this extractive capitalist system, but that is about shared ownership and community wealth.
And
You,
almost every tradition has a tradition of canceling debt, right? And of
yes.
reset and rebirth and that kind
Yes.
of engagement with, it's not about claiming debts from 200 years ago. It's about what you can create now and the community you can build together.
Yeah, and I mean that, and that, yeah, that the fact that it exists and it transcends, you know, traditions and faiths and cultures should just show us actually how not pie in the sky that is, how actually possible that is, that this has reverberated amongst yeah, people and cultures and traditions for thousands of years. The counter, you know, argument is always, well, this is, you know, progressive daydreams, or, you know, well, that would be nice, but that's not the real world. Well, the real history of our world has these traditions that, like you said, all have some form of this, whether it's Jubilee economics or debt canceling, about setting things right, which to me speaks to how actually that's the default that we need to get to. That is the realistic place that we need to go to, and that is anything but daydreams. That is how we are pulled and drawn to each other as people. Has not just when we talk about neighborliness from the Jesus tradition, is not just am I polite and I lend a ladder and I'm so glad my next door neighbor did lend a ladder when I was fighting wasps a few weeks ago. But it actually has real economic repercussions, and it has really a sense to how we design our neighborhoods, our housing. And you have chatted to me before that you really feel that right now where we are is not just sort of a continual accelerating crisis, but a tipping point, you've said. Yeah. Can you share a little bit about what you mean about this being a critical moment for us to a window of opportunity to change how we go about housing, to take us from housing crisis to housing justice?
So I also work with Social Innovation Canada, which is based in Toronto and also links into Waterloo. And we did a 2-year analysis of this financialization process, right? The financial capital buying out homes, and that stretching even into the suburbs, and even where they haven't bought the home, the bank owns so much of it that tiny shifts in price put people underwater, especially those who bought it recently. So that financialized ownership of housing, everything that drove that, we identified levers that drove that. What are the drivers of that shift? They're all shifting or have changed, right? You had hyper low interest rates. You had the government pulling back from investment. You have the emergence of these legal instruments like the REITs that make it really, really efficient to put your index, like your cheap finance, into, instead of making anything, just claiming the rents from cities. All of these levers are flipping, right? You have dramatic spikes in interest rates. You have your supply shocks, which are changing the construction prices. You have the government leaning in a huge way to housing across the whole system. But that can be into shared ownership housing, right? Housing that's perpetually affordable, not just 5 years affordable, right? That could be, if we need to build so many homes, let's build them to right standards so that we're not vulnerable to the next oil shock, right? And then on top of that, you had for years and years a sector, a social housing and social support sector that was just starved for resources, that was struggling to keep their head above water, responding to these real crises on the ground, but under capacity. And they've been now supported for years through this high affordable housing, so that the network of the community foundations and the housing, they're still in crisis. But the crisis is so big that they're in a better position with more capacity than they've ever had. And the institutional structures and the emergence of movements around the land trust that are deeply anchored into, you know, it's the housing crisis in Waterloo is the number one priority of CEOs, right? Because you can't start a company here if you can't attract talent, and you can't attract talent if people don't want to move their families here, and the families can't afford to live near all of this beautiful amenity. Right? So the process of extracting rent destroys our capacity to create wealth.
Wow.
And so all of that shipping. So we have this huge moment of opportunity to actually move some funds and some finance and some of that policy into creating social wealth corridors that create as much vibrancy and wealth as they can, but they don't just try and claim it and extract some of it, stays in the community. So we're working on designs of, you know, funds and interventions, and there's a lot that's emerging.
It's really easy, I think, in this in podcast world and in these conversations to kind of stay behind the glass and just be thinking about like the information and I often do that myself personally. Like I want to just kind of think about it and want to be a problem solver, and it's actually a way to keep the emotional distance, because this can be a very overwhelming thing. I actually get emotional when you talk about that stuff, and particularly when you talk about not just housing that's affordable for 5 years, but perpetually affordable. I get emotional because I think that That is so, what you're proposing is this imagination for something. And when I say imagination, I mean capacity to see, not something that is fake. Capacity to see something that is so outside of what we're conditioned to believe is possible. And again, the idea of there's this Old Testament tradition of the prophetic imagination, the ability to see beyond what the system has told you, what the empire has told you is this is the way it is, and there's no other way around it. This is the status quo. To not just think about can we get house prices to stop going up, to not just think about can we make emergency shelters obsolete. I want both of those things to happen. But to actually even think deeper and think, what does it look like to have perpetually affordable housing? So it's not just, whew, like we found a way to, by the skin of our teeth, escape this crisis for the next generation, for millennials and Zoomers, and we'll have to, do it again and again and again every time the levees start to shake. And the idea of thinking about what does it mean to actually create things that are perpetually just is to me just stunning and beautiful, and it gives me like a lot of pause, that it's something we almost can't even fathom. And so I'm really grateful that you even put that out, that not only is that an idea, that that is possible, and that that's where we need to go. So I say that just because it is easy to just think about this as facts and figures and systems, but this is we're talking about people's lives, and we're talking about all of our collective lives. And so it's just I'm really grateful for the way you're able to, for the work you're doing, and for the way you're able to just articulate things in a way that open up my imagination to what's possible, and I hope open up our imaginations to see beyond what is the water that we're swimming in, to see that there are better, more just ways of sharing life and community.
I want to just talk about this perpetual affordability for a bit and then really ground into like that kind of practical on the ground, like what we can do. I'm so happy you talked about perpetual affordability as something that can sort of shift things and it seems almost impossible. Because I think the key piece is it's not just possible and easy. You can just as easily structure and perpetualize non-perpetual affordability once you're paying to build a building. It's the legal structure and the way you build it. And there's such good models now. But it's necessary. It's what the scaling laws of cities mean is that as cities get denser, they get richer and there's more rent to extract. So that's value, right? If that's been claimed, more has been claimed and taken out. So it's harder to fix. It would be much more expensive to buy this land later than it is before the city grows and gets denser.
Right, which I think
And cities are hard
that's something people get, that it's that okay thing that prices go up as value increases. Yeah, for sure.
And fixing problems earlier is always cheaper than fixing them later. So by paying the equal amount or more to buy 10 years or 20 years or 40 years, you're saying you're going to pay more than that later. So you're kicking the problem down the road to when it's harder, possibly even impossible to solve,
Just to go
right?
back
More of
here,
the power's
I ran
gone.
into this exact thing when thinking about these wasps that have been making their home in the side of my place, and that exact principle of if we don't deal with this now, I might literally be dealing with a giant wasp's nest this spring. And so I just think that's a really important thing not to overlook, and that should make so much sense to us. Fixing a problem now is always going to be more effective and cheaper than to let the problem spin out of control and just to push it down the road.
If you have one wasp that's got into your building, like, do you ask the wasp to leave? Or do you ask the wasp be nice for 2 weeks before having more children?
That's yeah, absolutely. That is a
Which one do you
perfect
choose?
way to put it.
They're about the same price.
I
Which are you going to
feel
choose?
attacked, but I also feel that so deeply that that is a perfect way to talk about it, to
One
think
is
about it.
not a solution. One is
No.
wasting a moment of political opportunity, getting everyone elected one more time, and then having to solve a problem that's 10 or 20 times bigger.
Yeah.
And you didn't, you
Yeah.
don't have to perpetual. We have lots of examples of perpetual, they still work. And lots of examples where you've lost it after 20 years. One of the biggest problems is our loss of natural affordability. Because, people say 20 years seemed like a long time 20 years ago, and we now have to find a way to buy all those buildings.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
the power has shifted, right? We have it's anchored in community now. There's going to be more online shopping. There's going to be more New York Stock Exchange ownership. So use the community capacity that democracy, what we've been able to build on this ownership of our own homes and our own wealth, use that to fix it, to sustain it so we can keep making value by being together in communities. So making these social wealth corridors, that's the only way. It is actually a problem of abundance, right? It is just the wealth we create by being together. If it's claimed and shipped somewhere else, it's not here. That's it. If it is here, we have all of that wealth to secure ourselves, to secure our retirements and our kids and our neighbors, and to serve and to do what we wish to do, and like follow, all of that. And if we don't, we it loses that capacity to be in community
So we're in this moment, we're in this tipping point. We're right now, it is late October 2022. We have had a federal election, we've had a provincial election, we've had municipal elections. And like I said, it's easy at that point for us to go, and we hope people are casting those informed votes, and they're voting for candidates who, as Steph talked about last week, have lived experiences with those who are struggling with housing, with the housing injustice, with those who are on the who are street involved. But past that, we cannot just say, "Well, I did that. I cast my vote." Because like you said, this is not a threat that only rears its head during election season. This is a threat to communities, to families, to kids, to young people, to the elderly, to particularly to street involved people and our neighbors who live with disabilities. So we're in this moment. We can't just look at it as it's an election issue and then sign off and let our elected officials handle it. What are things that regular people can do with their time, with their energy, with their finances to respond in this moment of this tipping point with housing?
But there's one political action that makes a big difference right now, and that is perpetual affordability is different, right? And so federally, it needs to be an issue that supporting 20 years of affordability should not get you the best rates from federal funding, from CMHC. Perpetual affordability needs to get a better rate than kicking it down the road until it's harder and more expensive to solve. So that's an ask, That's an ask that if you're part of a community association, you put forward, you have a liberal or someone who's federally engaged in some way, talk to them and say,
For
oh, what are you doing on this?
yeah, and as individuals, and I know a lot of folks listening are in United Church land because that's part of where the hub and Trinity United come from, and so and the power of a church, of any community organization, but for those I know who are listening or from churches, from United Churches, the power of any community, a community of faith, a congregation, a local group, to come together and to insist, to demand, to phone, to write a letter, to draft a letter, and as Laura May Lindo said, draft a letter to all the different politicians so that they have to figure out and kind of figure out how they're going to respond and what are they going to say, and it puts pressure on them for better rates for perpetually affordable designs and systems and actors.
And you raise an important point with the example of UPRC and Kindred Works. like purpose aligned ownership makes a big difference, that it's actually
Yes,
aligned
you
with
talked about that.
the purpose of the, so any perpetual ownership, but also building ownership, offering good and supportive rates to those organizations that do the relational work over time, and their purpose aligns with that kind of ownership. That's well within the mandate of what's going forward. It's not been locked in, right? Everyone gets the same. And so we're not offering any advantage to those who are doing a whole bunch more work to hold value in community forever.
That's and yeah, you mentioned UPRC is the United Property Resource Commission. It's a new department of the United Church of Canada that is dedicated to housing justice. And I think yeah, now they're going kind of by kindred works, and they are involved in what you talked about at the beginning, which is an organization that has purpose is inextricably tied and is legally legislated into their mission. And I hope we and I'm sure we will be able to have folks from Kindred Works. And my friend Lauren is working with Kindred Works right now, Lauren Hodgson, and they're doing really amazing stuff, especially in a world where churches and buildings are needing to be reimagined and are needing to change and are needing to be sold. And so that's just a real two really great organizations to bring up. So I just want to recapture that. So pressuring that our politicians, we need an advantage for perpetually afford for the folks who are doing the work to make things perpetually affordable and who are doing community invested, purpose driven work when it comes to housing, not just what is growth and what's the biggest profit, but that they have purpose intrinsically tied into their mission, and that their boards, their leaders have a mandate to have community investment and community purpose in their work.
If you make it totally flat, it's making a choice. It always flows out, right? You need to lock that value and hold it in communities, somebody who cares in some way. So purpose-driven ownership, and some big levers in that space are interest rates and the guarantees. So it's your risk and your return, your cost of money, and that huge, that's driven by federal policy in large part through the Canadian Mortgage Association. So getting the lever of offering better interest rates to those who are offering this forever return, securing people's lives and communities. It's
Awesome.
even a little advantage is transformative.
Awesome. Yeah. So being able to yeah to affect those interest rates and yeah how the how the
Legal mechanisms.
yeah how the legal mechanisms are able to support that, because and that's just a really again another really good metaphor that yeah when things are flat, things leak out. We need to find a way to capture and lock in the value of communities of people being together, of and give the advantage to organizations who want to feed and nourish that. Because as you said, we are built to create wealth, and we're talking good, healthy wealth, not hoarded wealth, but wealth that is distributed. Abundance is a kind of a Christian-y word that would come up in my circles, that we're built to create abundance when we're together, when we're serving as a body, as a community. And so rather than this model of years ago is move out to the suburbs and put up your fence and have your get your isolated life, and more you don't even know your neighbor. And now this model of basically outsourcing everything from how we shop to how we get our food, everything has become more and more distant from being able to benefit the community, being created by the community. But I just, again, it makes me emotional to think that what you're saying is not just this abstract idea. This is so possible, and in fact, it's the way we have to be able to move to have communities who are producing these things and this, and have community wealth at the center of how we think and design housing and
Yeah,
whole
and these
neighborhoods.
global flows. Yeah, these global flows can be amazing for creating galleries in down New York or whatever else, right? But it's not the same. It's not gonna like water the fields and hold wealth and make sure that we're able to protect people going through a break in Waterloo or dealing with any kind of struggle or protect our kids if they're not employed for whatever reason, right? You have to do both.
Kirsten, you just are able, you have such a window into so many aspects because of your experience and your dedication and your, and in particular, I just want to say your passion behind this is so inspiring. And I've been chatting with folks who have been listening to the show and giving really lovely feedback. And many of them are coming from places where they're working on the ground. They're working in these either nonprofits or they're volunteers or they're working in churches who have encampments that they're trying to create space for that are literally on their doorstep, literally at the front of their church, and they're trying to find a way to support and be in solidarity. And the situation can feel as verbatim from one of my friends and a person I deeply respect can feel so grim is what he said. The situation can feel so grim. And so it there's a real need for hope here. And I don't say that in the sense because if we just hope and we just put on Pollyanna-ish eyes and our rose-colored glasses, everything will get better. But there's a need for hope because the despair can be so, it can freeze us in place. It can make us feel like, well, it's just too big a problem to solve. And so it gives me so much hope to hear your passion that is coupled. It's one thing to be super passionate, but you bring this passion to such a critical issue with just, it brings me so much hope with such a technical expertise and such brilliance and a genius as to your work. And I think for those of us who are feeling the grimness of the situation, to know that you're hard at work, like you're just talking about these things today. This is an hour that Kirsten has given us. She's going to go right back to writing proposals and looking for partners. And you're doing this work, and so it just brings me so much inspiration and hope to know that you're out there and that you're working away at this. And so I'm really grateful for you chatting today, and again, even more grateful for the work that you're doing. And I really look forward to being able to have another episode with you on, and to be able to have those who are listening support and follow the work that you are doing, that Leadership Waterloo Region is doing. So, Kirsten, how can people stay connected with your work, with the work of Leadership Waterloo Region? We're going to post Keepers of the Circle as well. If there are any other organizations that you want to talk about, they have an event, or we can follow their work. This is your time. Let us know, where should we follow? Where should we stay connected?
I'm so grateful for what you're doing with this podcast and the way you're sort of bringing all these pieces together. You almost can't go anywhere in this space without hearing people talking about like the example and the model and the leadership of the churches and especially United Church and all of the sort of groups that are brought along through that. So incredibly grateful for all of that.
Trinity is doing amazing work, making a church that has made it their primary mission not to sign more people up for Sunday morning services, not to build a bigger sanctuary, but their primary mission is affordable housing. So they are doing incredible stuff, and they are not the only church or United Church or community organization. But I do just want to shout out they're making this podcast possible as well. They're doing amazing work.
And at the same time, recognize the urgency of what we all face, right? Winter's coming, and maybe we can get the funds in place to have buildings 2, 3, 4 years down the road. What are we going to do now
Yeah.
between now and when it gets too cold to be outside? I'm gonna open
Yes.
the barracks.
Exactly.
What spaces can we find? Can we open up in our own communities and our neighborhoods? Like if you think about the response in community at the start of the pandemic, like we were calling each other and saying, "You okay? You okay? You okay?" We were opening hotels,
Yeah.
and that the crisis is, if anything, worse. And yet we're, is our response still like day to day in communities at that level? Like you get through one crisis. And the good thing is when we build those connections, like they sustain us. So this, I think this is airing just after the municipal election, so I don't need to share any of my hopes for that election.
We'll hold those just live right now. We'll hold those hopes
Yeah,
live right
yeah.
now.
But this is the most pivotal moment in terms of local politics because you have new leadership, right, in key roles. Whatever happens, we have new leadership in key roles, and people are building relationships and figuring out their priorities and what they're hearing from their communities and from each neighborhood, and hearing the priority of building together and building supportively and getting that perpetual affordability and getting buildings open to respond to the crisis now. That shapes people's agenda, right? So just making one actual relationship with one person who's been elected, a counselor, region, school board, whatever makes sense. That shapes, there's nobody more influential than the people who go on bike rides with their counselor and show them like the community, take people into relation with those with lived experience, and just give leaders the chance to serve and to build those relationships in a genuine way. And it is generative, right? Like, it's nice. There's nothing people predict wrong more than that they think they're going to hate knocking doors, or they think they're going to hate having a potluck, or they think, and they come back happier than they've ever been, and like you get smarter and you get happier and like express gratitude and meet people. You think you're going to hate it, but you won't. Trust me.
That's a good reminder.
So that relationship with the counselor, and then like find somebody who's doing some actual work on the ground. What is with the working center, or we have this model of Better Tent City, right? Like, you can just bring food, go to the encampments, listen to someone, like find some way to actually have a direct relationship with somebody so that you can speak to that, right? Because everything beyond that direct relation doesn't matter. Actual people make every single one of these decisions. And they make them in relation with those who made the uncomfortable effort of talking to them. It's super uncomfortable. It's not at all easy. On that front, I will give a bit of a plug for Leadership Waterloo Region, because again, I think that network is one of the best ways for anyone to connect in with, 500 of our sort of most committed leaders in the region. We have Fresh Innovators, which are talks that bring leaders and thinkers and community members together in a panel. So our next one is Thursday at Kitchener Public Library. All the details are on our
And
website.
so that's Thursday, October 27th.
Thursday, October 27th. But Fresh Innovators continues. So we have these events on an ongoing basis. And then we have a Fab 500 bash on November 3rd at Tapestry Hall in Cambridge. And that's our big celebration for, like, we've reached 500 alumni, and we want to build that network and connect it and share it as broadly as we can in the community. So it's a celebration. It's at Tapestry Hall, which has that beautiful sculptures by Philip Beasley. So if you haven't seen them, definitely you'll want to see these like responsive, beautiful sculptures.
Love
And
it.
it's just like some of my favorite people in the world. So in terms
Perfect.
of like jumping into a network like that, come out to that gathering. You'll meet people, and every one of those people has built, networks of people with lived experience and in leadership and in their professional across all different fields.
Awesome.
So come to the Fab 500 Bash on November 3rd, Tapestry Hall in Cambridge.
Love it.
Connect with Leadership Waterloo Region. And then on the finance side, there's like we have some of the best models. We have Union Cooperative, just bought their first property, closed on it. And that's a model of shared perpetual ownership, investing in solidarity with your neighbors. So now you don't have the NIMBYs on one side and the affordable housing on the other. Everyone invests in making these buildings and managing them for forever affordable. So become a member, invest directly, like put a bit of your retirement. It's not coupled to the financial market. It's like deeply resilient finance. So it's a very good financial choice to get some of your money into this kind of community wealth. And it's a community, right? It's with a shared governance model. So Union Cooperative, you can join them. And then as soon as you, by joining, you're a member, invested your own money in solidarity with building this affordable housing and like saving actual units for forever affordability. The group that's doing the development I mentioned, Waterloo Region Community Foundation, worked with Kindred Credit Union to launch a fund, a GIC. So that's a new model of investing in this kind of really generative, local, perpetual affordability, purpose-driven development project. Our project can apply to it. Any kind of other development projects can apply to this fund, and there's more funds emerging, but you can invest in that GIC now through Kindred Credit Union. I mean, banking with a credit union is a great choice as well. Friends who have tried to get a mortgage and, you know, they can't get them at the big banks, but they sit down with, you know, senior leadership in their local credit union and make it happen because they can.
There's a Kindred Credit Union literally down the street from me. So, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, lots and lots to do, but just like have a relationship with someone. And then when it's comfortable or, you know, today, whichever you prefer, put some of your money in it.
Yeah. Awesome. I can't thank you enough for making the time today. And I really look forward to being able to chat again and go down and explore kind of even more fully some of the intersections and aspects of housing justice that we've kind of just touched on today. I feel like this has just been a really good kind of overview when we think about systems and how we rethink our systems of housing and particularly that this piece of what does it look like to actually have community wealth. It's been a really, really beautiful conversation for me to be a part of, and I hope and I know our listeners will feel the same way. So I'm really grateful for this conversation, and again, like I said, even more for the work that you're doing, Kirsten. So thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, and thank you for everything that you're doing, Adam. Continually admiring all these pieces, and I'm happy to talk more. And I feel like I understood this little piece of the system. So the more I can learn from the community that you're building through this podcast and engage with what's coming up and work out how can we direct resources and build this together, the better. So happy to talk more with anyone.
We will. Yeah, we definitely will. That's so much. So that's we'll call it a day from there. And we look forward to having folks who are listening in. We'll be back next week, continuing to talk about how we move from housing crisis to housing justice. Thanks so much for being here, Kirsten, for Winter is Coming from The Hub and Trinity United. I'm Adam Cresswell, and we will talk to you next week. See you later.